This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chui Lin. How many senses do you have? Just five? Not so, according to the 19th century Austrian philosopher Rudolf Steiner. He said we have 12, and knowing these 12 can help us learn and develop. Here to tell us more about Rudolf Steiner's 12 senses and how we can use them in child development is Becky Rutherford, a curative educator from Pennsylvania. Becky holds degrees in art therapy and has been working with children and adolescents with special needs for over 35 years. She's also an experienced Waldorf classroom teacher. Welcome to the show, Becky.
Thanks for having me.
First up, curative educator, Waldorf classroom, these are not phrases that we hear a lot. Perhaps you could tell us what it is that you do.
Well, first I'll talk a little bit about Waldorf education. Started about 100 years ago out of the philosophy of that same man, Rudolf Steiner. Waldorf education is a holistic approach to pedagogy, seeking to educate the head and the heart and the hands of a child. And we approach this in a developmental way. Parents are always excited if their three-year-old shows them that they've learned how to read, and they think, well, we'll just give them more things to read, when in fact the three-year-old needs to play and learn through their body. Middle school offers opportunities for learning through the imagination, and high school is the time when we really center on development of analytical thinking, critical thinking. We see every child as someone who brings a kind of perfectness to earth, and we are working to help that individual perfection come to expression. Curative education comes out of the same philosophy. We also work in a holistic way. Right now, the trend in special education and remediation is based on behavior modification. People who work with children with autism will be familiar with the technique called applied behavior analysis, which is based on rewarding the correct behavior of the child. In curative education, we look at the whole child and work in a similar way that we would work with typically developing children, making sure that the head, the heart, and the hands all have a chance to be educated and work towards their individual expression. Just because you're not the most talented musician doesn't mean you don't get to learn to play an instrument.
How do the 12 senses factor in? The five senses, smell, taste, sight, hear, touch. 12 senses, are they related to the head, the heart, and the hands?
Yes, very much so. But first, let's just take a step back, because in mainstream literature, particularly in neuroscience or occupational therapy, we already consider 9 senses. In addition to the 5, we talk about sense of proprioception or sense of movement. Proprioception is the sense organ for proprioception are those particular cells found mostly in the joints of the human body, and they give us information about where the body is in space. The second one that I want to speak about is the sense of the vestibular, has to do with establishing our balance. This is also well described in mainstream literature. What's interesting is that Rudolf Steiner was talking about it at the turn of the century, and it was only begun to be discussed and researched in the 1970s. Then we move on to what Rudolf Steiner referred to as the sense of life, how we're able to determine our sense of body, emotional well-being. This is beginning to be discussed in neuroscience as the somatic sense, the sense of the body, looking to the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system as the sense organ that gives us that information. Then we have a sense that Rudolf Steiner, in a way that confuses people, teased away from the sense of touch, and that's the sense of warmth, our ability to determine the relative warmth in a physical sense, and also our ability to determine the emotional warmth of a situation or of a person. And this in neurological and physiological literature in the mainstream is called the caloric sense. So that actually only leaves us with 3 ones that Steiner has described, and the rest of the world hasn't quite developed an approach to them as a concept. That would be sense of word, our ability to understand and distinguish between noise, singing, music, and human speech, even when you don't understand the language. All of us have had that experience, particularly in Malaysia, where so many languages are so effortlessly spoken, that you might hear a language that you do not understand, but you certainly know that it's human speech. And when you're learning a new language, and there's just a stream of words you don't understand, and then somehow a word pops up in that stream that you do know, everyone has had that experience, how that enlightens, because coupled then with the sense of word is the next higher sense, the sense of thought or meaning. This enables us to follow the train of thought of another person through reading, through listening, through conversation. Now, the highest sense, which is really based on the development of all the other senses, is what could be called the sense of the individuality of the other. It's not our sense of our own individuality, which any good educator in any methodology will tell you comes from a graduating, developing consciousness that comes from our body activity, running and playing and jumping, all those things that we need to do as children. But the sense of the I, the individual of the other, is something that all of us still need to become much more sensitized to. You only have to look in the newspaper to see that we still don't treat each other really as other human beings.
Is the idea here then that the 12 senses need to be in balance developmentally, or, you know, so when we apply this to education or to looking at a child and that child's development, what's the aim here in terms of the 12 senses? Do you want them all to be working in harmony, or are we aiming to try and, you know, rectify imbalances?
I think both are very good a description of how we would work. Understanding that our senses that come to us through our physical body, sense of touch, sense of life or the somatic sense, sense of movement and sense of balance, are ones that need to be the foundation for the rest of the development of the child. And a simple, natural way of being in the world will help develop these senses in the most healthy way. Lots of time outside, lots of time walking in nature, no time spent in front of a screen, certainly not before the age of 7, ideally not before the age of 12, and that includes iPads and iPhones and tablets and television. Because even though parents can say, oh, there's such educational things on television, it's time spent away when the child could be engaged with their own physical body, their own physical sensations. So playgrounds and cuddling with mom and roughhousing with dad are the best way to build these capacities. For the child with special needs, this is particularly important because it's these areas that may be compromised due to a disability or to brain damage or to a sensory processing difficulty such as autism. And there need to be opportunities to engage with the physical body in a playful context that has meaning and security. So where the typical child, we can just take them to the playground. The child who is still struggling to integrate their sensory experiences will need something that is a bit more structured by the adult. So there could be an obstacle course set up, and the obstacle course's sequence is the same every day, that you're walking on beanbags, then you crawl through a little tunnel, then you jump on the trampoline, and then you sit down. Something as simple as that. But the fact that it's repeated gives a context wherein the child can learn with more security, because the sense impressions now can be predicted.
iPads, TVs, you know, that notion of putting a child in front of a screen, I think that's most often associated with trying to avoid boredom, or, you know, trying to avoid the classic, you know,
Mom, I'm bored.
Exactly. So how does boredom factor into how the 12 senses interact in terms of how a child understands the world? You know, is boredom an important part? Because I think most of us can remember being a child and being left to our own devices and having that sense of boredom, you know, and then parents give you a book or parents put you in front of a television.
I think being bored is a gift that we can give to our children. Of course, this has its developmental aspect. A 7-year-old has a lot more resources to make themselves feel interested and engaged out of their own interactivity than a 2-year-old does. But by providing a variety of play opportunities, because they're feeling uncomfortable because they're bored, they can begin to learn how to make themselves unbored. And when we're constantly supplying a kind of entertainment for them, this is actually taking away from a very important developmental step and a step that allows them to develop their own humanity. This is my interest. I'm working out of my curiosity. This is what I can see comes next. You can see how all of the 12 senses could be well engaged when the child is allowed to feel bored and then allowed to come to calmness and engage themselves again.
Could you give us an example of how all 12 senses could be engaged in an activity? Well, the example I have here is, you know, entering a restaurant and ordering fried rice, although I'm not sure how many children do that on a regular basis. But, you know, let's just use that. So if I did, you know, walk into a restaurant, sit down, order a plate of fried rice, how have the 12 senses sort of interacted with one another?
Okay. Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of a typically developing person and a person who has some compromises in their development. So in order to walk into the restaurant, you've well engaged your senses of movement and balance. In order to know that you're hungry, your sense of life has told you, I'm feeling a little hungry. Your sense of touch has been involved in being able to move from the car to the restaurant to sit down in the chair. You've had to motor plan an idea how to maneuver between the tables in order to find your chair and sit down in it. And of course, all of this is done quite unconsciously for the child who is developing in a typical way, and certainly for the adult. And then you sit down and you catch the eye of the waiter to come over and take your order. Now you can sense if this waiter is a nice guy, a busy guy, a guy who really doesn't care about his job, a guy who's really friendly and engaged, someone who's just had a laugh with their colleagues or they're in a good mood. You might sense that that person is sad or even depressed, but all of your senses of warmth and hearing and word and thought and the individuality of the other have been engaged to form a kind of living picture of that other person. And you will respond in the way that you respond out of your own character, your own personality. But there certainly has been a lot of sense impressions that have led you to that understanding. And then smelling and tasting and the feel of the rice inside your mouth, engaging the sense of touch. Vision is our most powerful sense capacity, and that has had an influence on how you walked, how you moved, how you were able to maneuver around the tables, how you were able to distinguish that there was a person standing there to take your order. All of us can remember when we haven't felt well, and then we become actually more conscious in the senses that ideally just remain on an unconscious level. We're not always conscious of how our feet feel as we walk across the carpet. But if you have a fever or you're not feeling well in some way, or if you have pain in your body as an older person, these motor activities will become more, you'll have more awareness of them. The child with special needs who doesn't integrate their sense impressions in a whole way will have a lot of difficulty going to a noisy restaurant with mom and dad to eat the yummy fried rice. And they may communicate their difficulty in processing their sense impressions through their behavior. And the behavior may be misinterpreted by the teacher or by the parent or by the helper as a naughty boy, a spoiled boy, someone who doesn't know how to behave in a restaurant. When in fact, even though perhaps their sense of movement and balance are well established, their sense of touch is all right, there's a big fan in the ceiling of that restaurant. And it's going around and around and around and around. And it's making a kind of thump, 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 thump noise. Things that we screen out and don't even notice, and they don't create in us anxiety or an emotional response of any kind. But for the child who isn't able to integrate this sense impression of the noise and the repetitive movement of the fan, may be feeling so uncomfortable, so fearful, that they will act out in negative behavior. So it's best if educators and parents and helpers really are sensitive to the experience of the child and can look beyond the temper tantrum or the whining or even the aggression and see that that's really telling something about their experience.
I'm speaking today with Becky Rutherford, curative educator and social therapist. We've been discussing child development through the 12 senses. Up next, the context in which Rudolf Steiner laid down the theories for these 12 senses, as well as how it's used as a framework to guide teaching and learning. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Becky Rutherford, curative educator and social therapist. We're discussing child development through the 12 senses. As mentioned earlier, Rudolf Steiner, an Austrian philosopher, was the one who laid the theories down for these 12 senses. What was the context in which this theory was developed? What motivated him?
Rudolf Steiner had a very expanded view of the human being, both through child development and as our development continues into youth, middle age, and old age. And he was able to separate some of the experiences and realities of our human experience in a way that allows us to understand ourselves and understand the other person in more depth and empathy.
How did these senses then become worked into a, you know, a scientific framework for education, especially when it comes to child development and child development for children with special needs in particular?
Mm-hmm. Well, as we mentioned in the first part of the program, most of these senses are now well described in mainstream literature, in neuroscience, in child development. And this gives us an understanding of the child, helps us to assess the child when we can see a disturbance in one of the sense areas, and then helps us to provide the best environment and the best activity that will help to balance a difficulty that we have observed.
Earlier you talked about it being important for educators and parents to empathize with a child who might be experiencing, you know, sense impressions that don't make sense or might be having a completely different impression of a setting or a scene. How do we do that? I mean, with so much of our lives being working almost subconsciously, I would filter out that fan. You know, the crowd of people would be a mere disturbance to getting a seat. I wouldn't be upset or overwhelmed by the noise. If you're talking about a child who might have difficulty even expressing why they find this anxiety creating, how do you empathize?
Well, any mother, any helper, any good teacher knows how to read their child. They might not always know the answer, but they are able to take from the child many, many questions. An infant that's crying, the mother or the helper responds at once. They might not know exactly what is causing the crying, but they feel the necessity to bring into harmony something that's not in harmony. And that comes with a growing sensitivity of understanding that particular child. So when you've got your six-day-old baby, you don't know why they're crying. You've got a year-and-a-half-old toddler, you figure out pretty good reason why they're crying because you develop your own empathetic and sensitivity to understanding the needs of the child. I think working with children, particularly with children with special needs, they're really giving us something as well. They're demanding that we slow down. They're demanding that we use our own senses to understand them. And in doing that, we are able to understand ourselves. And in doing that, we see that there's always the need to improve, to become more sensitive, more patient, more understanding. It's not like there's a cookbook. There's not a way you can turn to the chapter on autism and know everything you're supposed to know, but rather here's a child in front of you who has lots of aspects to their personality, and having autism is one aspect of who they are. So our approach is always going to be a holistic approach, looking at the whole child. What are their interests? How do they interact with their sense world that's different from another child who also has a sensory imbalance but reacts differently? So what it comes down to is that it is always the relationship that guides us in understanding the child and guides us in providing the right activity.
A lot of education is standardized or works around, you know, a basic framework. You enter this grade, you will read this book, we will have these tests. When it comes to applying the 12 senses and, you know, the Waldorf education, is there also a similar framework of sorts, or is everything personalized always?
The interesting thing is that Waldorf education provides a child with a kind of expectation in a developmentally appropriate way that we are responsible for each other. We're a group. We're a group of humans on the planet in the biggest picture. I'll give you an example. Your early childhood teacher was in a Waldorf classroom, was very proud that all of her little four-year-olds now carried their plate to the sink by themselves after their lunch. And that indeed was a good accomplishment, shows skill building, shows self-regulation. And an advisor came to look at the classroom and said, no. Each day, one child helps to collect the plates for everybody. Everybody takes their turn in serving the other. So this unfolds in a developmental way, going from a little one who is very much part of the group to the 18-year-old who does an independent project specifically on their interests and makes a comprehensive presentation about this project. There's a lot of ground to cover in between that, those two polarities. So the understanding of the individual child is a thread that goes through the curriculum, but this reality that we have a responsibility for each other also goes through. I think many people around the world are becoming less and less satisfied with an education that's based on testing and assessment and testing and grades, and seeing that the child at the end of the day is tired, they're anxious, they don't sleep well, they say they don't like school. What we want and what we need in the world is people, young people, who can think in freedom. And that means you are free to put your ideas into action, and you're free from your own difficulties of procrastination. You're free from emotional worries that what will people think, but your thinking has been really shaped by your feeling of responsibility for the other. And we have big problems facing our world, and we need big, creative, free thinkers to solve these problems. And I'm not sure you get that result when an educational system is very standardized and based on testing.
You referenced early childhood development. Let's talk about early childhood education. Is there a sequence at which the senses come into play when we're talking about regular, a neuronormative child developing in a typical way?
Mm-hmm. These happen quite naturally, and parents shouldn't worry if they're listening to this program and they think, oh my goodness, I'm not stimulating senses. Our sense capacities and our ability to integrate those experiences will simply happen in a normal way when there is enough opportunity to interface with the real world. That means building a fort out of the sofa cushions engages all the senses, really. Going to the park. Even if parents live in a small apartment in a condominium with no garden, there's still opportunities to play freely and play creatively. In a Waldorf kindergarten or preschool or a playgroup, people often wonder where the toys are. And what they will see instead are natural materials. They will see baskets of pine cones, baskets of seed pods. They will see lots of colored cloths and different kinds of wooden structures that can be turned into a boat or turned into a house or turned into a cabin in the woods, depending on the interest and imagination of the child. They'll see blocks of irregular shapes and sizes, and they will see very unarticulated shapes that could approximate a little animal, could approximate a person. And these lightly created toys allow for a lot of imaginative play with the child. There's a time for sitting on the floor and really feeling your sense of balance and your sense of touch and your sense of movement. All of these well-ordered sense impressions will give a good sense of life. Children will have a sense of well-being when there's a predictable rhythm to the day. That first there is free play, then there is circle time, then there's our snack, then there's our rest time. All of these things become anticipated, and this gives every child a sense of security. And that kind of real conscious outside structure to the day certainly is very supportive for educating the child with special needs as well.
Who are the people who are sending their children to a Waldorf classroom? In your experience, who are the parents who are curious, who are, you know, open to this?
Mm-hmm. For typically developing children, I think the parent who is concerned about the amount of stress and the lack of opportunity for imagination and creative play development will seek an alternative for their child, particularly in early childhood. Parents who have seen the addictive nature of media in their own lives, all of us are addicted to some form or another of checking our phones and checking our iPads, and they see that that is not what they want for their child. Just the way we would protect our children from other addictive substances, we protect them from the addiction of media. Naturally, most parents will look forward to the day when their young adult can share a glass of champagne with them at a special ceremony. But you would not offer that same glass of champagne to your three-year-old. It's a bit the same as offering an iPad to a three-year-old. Developmentally, it's not what they need.
You've been in town for a little while. Mm-hmm. What do you think the reception's like here in Malaysia to these ideas? Because we, you know, I'm a product of the education system here, and I can certainly say that we are, you know, big into rote learning. That's what we do. We do examinations. I would say almost diametrically opposite to what you're describing. Mm-hmm.
We had a three-day workshop, and it was attended by a number of parents who currently have their children in Waldorf playgroups, also by a few teachers who are undergoing Waldorf training in other parts of Asia, and then a number of people who were interested. I see, of course, when I travel, I'm kind of in Waldorf land wherever I go, but I see a growing interest in Malaysia and other parts of Asia of turning away from, I must say, a kind of Western imposed idea of education and being able to look back to their own heritage, their own ancestral roots of philosophy and understanding of the human being, and finding many, many correlations in that Asian heritage with how Waldorf education views the child. This is not a rapidly moving revolution, but at the moment, Waldorf education is the fastest growing independent school movement in the world. So many people are interested, and I know many children will have the fruits of this interest.
In a Waldorf classroom, would you see children who are developing typically in the same classroom as children who are experiencing learning difficulties?
This is a question that is answered by each individual school. In some countries, the model of inclusion, of including kids with learning challenges with typically developing children, is very much part of that Waldorf school. In other countries, this has not been the case, and what is developed alongside of the Waldorf School for Typical Children will be a school for kids with learning disabilities, or in the case of more extreme challenges, a school for curative education. I think that this is a very individual decision, and it depends a great deal on the child and a great deal on the teacher who will accept children of so many different kinds of learning styles into their classroom. I've also seen that when Waldorf schools are working on the inclusion model, that it works better for longer than in mainstream education. Because of this very early expectation that we are responsible for each other. We are our brother's keeper, and we are interested in the experience of the other. In mainstream education, it can work pretty well until about grade 3, when the children turn 9 years of age. And then, because this is the time when children really become much more sensitive of differences, then we begin to get social situations that exclude the child with special needs. The school that I come from in Pennsylvania, which is Camp Hill Special School, we had a very touching story from a parent who their son joined our school in grade 6. They had had a pretty good experience being mainstreamed in public school and came to us in grade 6 because that was no longer the case. And the father called up weeping one day to the director and said, "Something has happened in our family that never happened before, and that's that a friend from school called my son up on Saturday and asked, can we do something?" This social aspect is one of the areas that is most nurtured in a school which is exclusively for children with special needs, especially through early adolescence and high school.
Finally, because I imagine that this is the topic which has generated the most interest around the idea of the Waldorf classroom, when it comes to children with autism, what benefits have you seen directly? You know, what are the things that you've noticed in terms of the development of a child with autism?
Another word to describe autism would be fear. And the fear is based on many factors, but one is certainly the inability to integrate sense impressions in a way that is meaningful. When the sensory environment is created in such a way that it is predictable, that it is soft, and that it interacts with the child in a way that is pleasing and brings a sense of well-being rather than a shock, this is one of the things that I have observed, and also that parents comment on it, is that their child is no longer so frightened. They're no longer so anxious. Then, because the body opportunities for play are so rich, and they are the sense capacities that help us build on the rest of our abilities, language can begin to develop. And social situations can unfold in a way that is simply difficult when you're surrounded by fast-moving, loud, quick, clever, typical children who may leave the child with autism to the side, and their behavior is simply overwhelming for the child with autism. Since we group by age rather than ability in our school, it may well be that in a given classroom, let's say a fourth grade, there are kids who are profoundly impacted by brain damage, working alongside of children with autism, pretty capable kids with autism. This demands that the teacher works a lot on the weekends and prepares well, but it also affords that child with autism an opportunity to engender a sense of compassion and interest in the other. And I've seen lovely times where somebody with autism notices the child with brain damage needs a tissue, gets the tissue, and offers it, or even makes a slightly messy attempt at wiping the nose, and never gives any eye contact, typical of kids with autism, but nonetheless has followed through on a very tender social impulse.
Thank you very much, Becky. I've been speaking with Becky Rutherford, curative educator and social therapist. We've been discussing child development through the 12 senses and the Waldorf classroom, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.